Once you start building community around regenerative principles in the rangelands, you only have to impact and reach a handful of people to then see positive change at ecosystem scale. Because we are talking about such vast areas, the potential of that is staggering.
Hi, I'm Susie. You're listening to Soils for Life. In each episode, we bring you the stories of soil, the opportunities in the ground, and the challenges above it. The United Nations General Assembly recently voted 2026 as the International Year of the Rangelands and Pastoralists. An incredible 81% of Australia is considered rangelands. In this episode, we'll hear from three farmers who all grew up in the semi-arid rangelands with a deep connection to the environment and a desire to heal the land. Jodie Brown is a fourth generation farmer from Longreach in central West Queensland. The family farm, Latrobe Station, is certified organic, running cattle, goats and a couple of horses on around 45,000 acres. Growing up in this wide open landscape of the Mitchell Grass Downs, she's lived through three boom and bust seasons, which present an often conflicting image of the rangelands.
There's this juxtaposition, that idea of fragility and strength. It's such a turbulent climate out here. We have such volatile seasons and extremes and a lot of high temperatures and droughts. You're so aware of the presence of the land beneath you and just rolling out to the horizon as far as the eye can see. And the sky, like the sky has its own presence. It's so huge, you know, the big sky country. It really is a complete kaleidoscope of life, and it's a mosaic because of all the different species, right? There's different colours, textures, patterns, shapes. It's all happening. But it's once you're amongst it and you look down and into things that you see, like just the breathtaking diversity. Different types of species of grass, and then there could be 50 or 60 different annuals, little forbs and legumes and just different plant species. And then once you start talking bird life, lizards, wildlife, it's pretty phenomenal. The other thing that's really cool is that when you're looking at all these hundreds of different pasture species, they're nearly all native. Like the only species out here that we see enough of to recognize instantly is buffalo grass. And everything else is native, which is like amazing. We do have such volatile seasons and the conditions are so variable and the seed bank is just so immense and diverse that it really just depends on the season as to what species come up. So one year, you're walking around looking at 50, 60 different species within a matter of like meters or something, and that composition will be completely different to the next year just because the rain fell at a different time of year or temperature, or maybe the soil was stimulated in a different way, or maybe the plants that grew last year cycled the minerals and nutrients to be more welcoming to whatever germinated this season. Who doesn't want to live somewhere that just feels abundant with life? To actually feel like you are just part of this living, breathing ecosystem. So I just think it's the well-being of literally every living thing, including and especially humans, is to live somewhere like that and be part of something like that.
Jodie's experience is something that farmers can relate to around the world. However, the vast distances mean that it can be isolating. And Jodie felt a strong desire to connect with like-minded people.
I felt like the biggest challenge that I wanted to tackle was helping people find each other in the rangelands. It would be 6.5 years ago now. I kept asking that question. I've got to find people that are successfully doing regenerative grazing in the rangelands or in hot, dry conditions. And hoping to find someone out here, really. It's just actually hard to find people until you make a bit of noise. But anyhow, this woman said, oh, yeah, I can put you in touch with someone. Do you want to talk to a rancher from the Chihuahuan Desert in Mexico? And I was like, oh, okay. I was hoping for someone closer, but yeah, cool. And I just thought everyone I talked to is interested in Alejandro's story. It's really inspirational for people coming from dry areas to hear success stories from the desert.
Jody brought Alejandro Carrillo to her property to host the Regenerative Rangelands Conference. And whilst their properties are thousands of kilometres apart, they're so alike.
We're so similar, just incredible. If you go to, let's say, the areas near Long Ridge, or even on the Western Australia, or even Alice Springs, and you think that you're here in my ranch.
Alejandro, you've travelled the world sharing your story. Can you tell me how your connection to the rangelands evolved?
Yeah, I was born in Chihuahua City, which is, I would say, part of the desert. And when I was a kid, we did not have a ranch. But my dad really liked the hunting, so I always went with my dad. And I really like to be on the outdoors. So then I started spending my summers playing the cowboy in the Chihuahuan Desert. And I really like everything about nature, the cattle business and all that stuff. So I think that's how I start appreciating the Chihuahuan Desert.
Alejandro, I understand it's the largest and most biologically diverse desert in North America.
Chihuahua has like deserts and semi-arid, and then nice grasslands, and then forest, ranging from, let's say, 5 inches of precipitation per year to 30 inches of precipitation per year, going from 1,000 meter elevation to 3,000 meter elevation.
What was it like before the ranchers moved in?
We can go back 300 years ago. It was inhabited by the Native Americans, you know, like Apache and Comanche. These were actually tall grasses, beautiful grasslands, full of life. And a lot of that wildlife was related to the water, like otters and beavers. So it was just completely different place than what we see today. Because remember that this land has tremendous wildlife, like wolves and grizzly bears and black bears and elk, bison, and the American antelope. So all those creatures really keep these beautiful grasslands in check. But even as early as 50 years ago, I do remember when I was a kid traveling from Chihuahua City to Texas and looking at the lands that are nearby my ranch, and they were still beautiful grasslands. A lot of degradation took place on the last 50 years to a point where we mostly have now bare ground and a lot of wood encroachment, the mesquite and cactus and things like that. So definitely we have completely broken the water cycle as we have lost vegetation. I personally spent a lot of summers on ranches in the desert, and it was a lot of fun, but I saw how the owners actually had a good year, but then two bad years and so on. As years passed by, it was more like suffering on the parts of the owners, more dead cows and more expenses. Because whatever you don't produce in your station or your ranch, you have to bring it from somewhere else, and those inputs start getting more expensive than just the price of the cattle.
You've been working hard on your ranch to heal the landscape, but how does the rest of the desert look?
Well, oh my God, it looks like the apocalypse. Lots of bare ground, very little grasses. The grasses are out there. They're annual grasses, and that they will completely depend on whether it rains or not. The perennial grasses are pretty much like sick, hungry, very oxidized grasses. I think it was at a point where we did not understand how nature worked, and we get out of sync, and that's when we start actually degrading the places. As the places start getting degraded or desertified, then usually everything gets more aggressive, like colder places, more heat, more thorns, more toxic plants, and so on. I think that's a message of nature saying, I'm going to remain here, but you're not going to remain here. So that's why we just cannot manage the same way we managed for many years, because conditions are different. We got to change course.
We need to be really very patient to wait for people to just get on board. But at the same time, ironically, we have the urgency because we're seeing that things are getting worse and worse as we are desertifying the places. less rain, more fires, thunderstorms, more flooding, and so on. So sometimes I feel we are in a bit of a race, and that we're encouraging and promoting this worldwide, so more ranchers and farmers really get on board.
The attitude of farmers and ranchers there in Australia is just great. They love what they do, which is the first step for you to have the passion to do what you do, and then to have the interest to keep doing it for multiple generations. And I always see opportunities and a lot of potential in Australia.
Jodie's search for people who share her passion and vision for healing the landscape brought her in contact with Glenn Landsberg. Glenn owns a small farm called Sunset in southwest Queensland, where he works as a natural resource management consultant. Growing up on his family's property in thick Mulga country inspired the work he does today. Glenn shares Alejandro's sense of urgency for change and can see the immense opportunity for transformation.
For me, growing up, I have very strong recollections of continually fighting with low rainfall and with drought, interspersed with the odd flood events. And you'd wait for so long, waiting for some rain to come. Your whole life, you watch your family and we're all praying for rain. And then it comes and landing on bare soils. I just thought it was natural for all our waterways out here to be soupy red messes of soil. You know, all the runoff from our rainfall, our rivers and things, are always just muddy. The DPI did tests up in this country and some of this hard mulga country, and when it gets that hard cap on the surface, you're looking at up to 90% runoff. So, you know, if you're in a 10-inch rainfall area, that's 1 inch to try and grow something. The rest just ends up down eroded gullies and gone off somewhere else. So, you know, it was that heartbreak growing up that you just watch all that water just disappearing.
Glenn, before becoming a resource management consultant, you worked as a bush pilot for 22 years. That must have given you an interesting bird's eye view of the rangelands.
Flying was a great perspective. Seeing it from the air, you get to see where it is damaged, and any bare soil or erosion really stands out from the air. There's a lot of damage, a lot of historical damage. The type of things that have caused it to lose its function can be as simple as a road put in the wrong way, or a pipeline, or a fence line, or an old bore drains. You know, the old artesian bore drains, because they're all on the fall, they dragged an extraordinary amount of water out of the country.
From the air, you can also see that grazing pressure is a major factor in the degradation of the rangelands.
Sometimes, you know, there's so much damage being done by extra grazing pressure, whether it's camels, goats, when they're not managed. And kangaroos are native, but we removed the lions from their landscape. The dingoes and the people who lived on them have suddenly all been taken out of the picture. So, you know, you see those photos of mouse plagues on the downs in that grain country. Well, when we get the kangaroo plagues, it's just like those mouse plagues. It is frightening. And it's because we've modified the landscape. We've taken out the controlling influences. That 500,000 acres that I was on, family properties, when Europeans first went to that area, that property was 3 million acres. It had 2 permanent waters on it. Every dry spell, every kangaroo, every emu, every dingo and every Aboriginal were camped around those 2 waters. So there'd be a massive culling, a massive reckoning on animal numbers. So when it did rain, there would be that time lag of where numbers had to build up again before they put too much pressure on the landscape. So first thing Europeans did was come in and remove those controlling factors. And one thing that we found, and it only happened fairly recently in most of this area where I am or west of here, the eastern grey kangaroo came out in around the 60s, and they were quite rare, like very rare. They're not migratory. They could only survive out here when all the waters were put in. He's talked to lots of old-timers who say that they remember when the eastern greys came out and they'd go and have a picnic to show the family. It was such a novelty. When the drought got really bad at the end of 2018, 2019, when people didn't have any stock left, the numbers were so high and the eastern greys were digging out any of those grasses that have established or evolved to have those really deep root systems like your Mitchell grasses and other natives to handle those dry periods. They were just digging them out of the ground. The numbers were so ridiculously large that a lot of damage was done.
You get really concerned because, of course, there's all these natural cycles that have been disrupted and there is a fragility there. It's almost like a cascade effect. Once you start disrupting one cycle, it feeds into another problem or another challenge, and then, yeah, it all spirals so quickly. You can start to see vast areas that are really under duress. I just like to think of it almost like a flip side of that. There's degradation here and we've got a long way to go, but it's already got that capacity for restoration, and we could just learn to either get out of the way in some instances or just help. Then imagine, like, the sky's the limit. Imagine how incredibly abundant and vibrant it can be out here when you already have seen glimpses of that everywhere. And the thought that that could be supercharged, it's really energizing. And every time we get good rain, it blows me away how quickly it can transform. You just get this carpet of green come up just almost immediately. And obviously, how healthy the landscape is plays into how well it recovers. It blows me away with its immense capability to recover, to be resilient.
Jodie sees great potential in the landscape and understands that sometimes nature needs a helping hand. And Glenn is working with Jodie to help her get ready for rain.
My parents and all my siblings have all moved elsewhere, but I certainly felt that I hadn't finished here and that I did owe the country and the communities a lot. And I just felt that there was still a lot to do to help people get out of that drought and flood cycle. From the air, you get to see where it is damaged, and any bare soil or erosion really stands out. But you can also see how sometimes the smallest of little interventions, because a lot of it's so incredibly flat, the smallest of interventions can help restore it. So I did start doing some work for NRMs when I got out of flying, doing this sort of work, helping people restore the country. And initially, most of that ended up being looking at the function of water and getting it working better. But that was an amazing opportunity and a learning opportunity for me too. Getting to talk to so many landholders and finding out where they are, what they're trying to do and their story, but sharing the stories. You know, a lot of people are sometimes embarrassed by things that they've tried that haven't worked. But quite often, when you get to talking about it, you find that little things that, you know, why it didn't work might just be some tiny little factor, and often the experience of someone else that worked out why something didn't work. And just by sharing those stories, you can help people solve what didn't work and get some really good success.
For people starting out, what are some of the basic principles for landholders to consider?
It's often just trying to imitate and encourage and help nature to do what it wants to do anyway. What is the big thing that's going to make that big difference for their regenerative dollar and can help them afford to do more restoration? So there is a lot of earthworks as a rule to slow down that movement of water through it, restore a lot of your natural billabongs and ponds. The ends have just blown out of them. They've just eroded and joined up and become eroded gullies. It's plugging the ends of them again. But when you, the scale that we're talking in the rangelands, we're talking massive scale. You know, wetland here might be 3,000 hectares. One of our biggest assets are the people who are there now, the stewards who are on the land now. They've got that connection. They are financially and emotionally very connected to the land. So looking at how can we help those people? One story I often tell, and poor bloke's probably sick of me telling his story, but it's just such a wonderful story. So the first thing that we're often looking at is, what is that biggest bang? What is going to give them a good result and for the least amount of money, or to make the most of the money that they've got to spend? So this one bloke in particular going and having a look at his place, and we could see on a satellite image that there was an old wetland there. And when we looked at it and we're talking about it, right out there on the bikes, they're often quite isolated. And he was saying that it only fills once every 10 years or so in really big flood events. So we started to ride around and have a look at it. And it's that interesting phenomenon that when you're living with your own kids all the time, you don't notice them growing. But if you only see your nieces and nephews once a year, they've grown a couple of inches and you go, oh, wow. Erosion features are very similar. When you're living and seeing them all the time, we just start to accept them as a part of nature or part of the scene. And we don't often see that they're getting worse and they're doing more and more damage all the time. So this wetland that we went to have a look at, there was a simple little erosion feature at the head of it. And it had just developed probably in the last 60, 70 years. And instead of all the little flows running directly into that wetland, they would jump, fall, all the overland flows falling into this erosion, getting carted off into another system elsewhere. All we had to do was just a simple little earthworks to direct that water back the way it used to flow. Very little cost. And it was in the middle of a drought. He had an 18 millimeter rainfall event. And from that one rainfall event, 3,000 lambs and 250 weaner cattle that were about to go on a truck for adjustment because he had no feed for them. He suddenly had instant feed and was able to keep them. But it was such a big area and was so productive. Now, in the 2 years after that was done, he had 18 runs into that wetland. So it's gone from one run every 10 years to 18 or 19 in 2 years. And each run was that incredibly productive. Now, in an ideal world, you'd love to be able to just spell it and keep animals away from it. But what it did mean, it was in a very big paddock. So the cost of fencing something like that off is a really high cost. But what it meant for him was that because it took grazing pressure off the rest of the big paddock, the rest of the big paddock started to grow a lot more ground cover when it started to rain again, and it all started to recover. Now, that same bloke, he was budgeting on $100,000 a year for drought feed, just every year. That's what he put into his budget for cottonseed and hay, that sort of thing. That same $100,000, instead of putting that into drought feed, he puts that into restoring country every year, and that is his drought mitigation.
Wow, yeah.
So you're asking that question, where do people start? And it is often looking for where is water doing damage and where can we safely put it back to work? Where are those high-functioning areas that aren't functioning and how can we put them back to work? But simply by keeping your soil there, slowing down that flow, making little mini wetlands in areas that are often otherwise just rolling downs country, the length of green growth, you get that water moving within the soil. It takes a little bit longer often to get that effect, but you start to get that drought mitigation because you're making the most of your rainfall. When you see that all working, what that does for your soul to see that landscape working, it's all worthwhile. It's all good.
Yeah, you worked with Jody Brown at the La Trobe station to get some quick wins in terms of rehydration works out there.
Jody's a lot more of that undulating downs, Mitchell grass country. Jody was doing some rehydration work and there was some historical erosion up there that even with some really good management, you get those erosion features that are draining enormous amounts of water out of an area, but they can't fix themselves without some sort of human intervention. They've got past the point of being able to heal themselves, certainly within our lifetimes and probably never really because they've got so bad. You know, they've become the new Grand Canyons.
The targeted earthworks that Glenn has been doing with Jody and others has slowed water down during flooding events, allowing it to soak into the landscape and support more grass growth and root development, which means healthier and more aerated soil and greater water absorption. Being able to bring back these natural systems means Jody couldn't be happier.
Glenn, who's quickly become one of my regen heroes, for him to come out and trial something that taps into all of these ideas, it's just hugely exciting. This most recent amount of work with the chain of ponds and the leaky weir only just filled up probably about a month ago from rain. And we did fly over them once the sumps and the earthworks full of water and just see the way that it had altered the water moving across the landscape. Even the young chopper pilot who flew me over the rehydration works, he commented, he said, "Oh, isn't it interesting that the creeks near where you've done this work, you can see water sitting in these creeks and spreading out from those creeks again, whereas the other creek systems that we flew over were actually empty already, like within a matter of days. And yet where this work had been done, the creeks had water, but also just this beautiful thin layer of water had spread out across the landscape, across the flats. You could see the sun reflecting up off it. And you just think, wow, comparing the amount of soil and plants that are now getting a drink for days and weeks after a rain event, whereas beforehand the top layer would have been dry within 24, 48 hours in most of those places. Part of that chain of ponds and remediation work there was also addressing some pretty severe erosion and a dam bank that kept blowing out. And that's all now intact, which is great. But where we've slowed the water, and you know, you're not stopping the water, you're just slowing it. But where we've slowed the water in several spots, there's also all this bird life that's come in. It's all these ducks and things cruising around on the water, which is just phenomenal. Like, we already had bird life here, but they come and go, like, pretty quickly. So to have a bit of an explosion in bird life, very cool. Dad was a little worried, are we going to get enough runoff into the dam still? But that concern around filling the dams was flipped, because actually a dam we would expect to stop running within days was running a week and a half later. So even though you try these things hoping for good things to happen, you don't really know until you do it. And it's just always surprising, but in a good way.
Slowing the flow of water on Jody's family property has been a learning experience with some very tangible results. The next step is to get water to infiltrate into these vast compacted landscapes, and Glenn says that livestock are a cost-effective solution to breaking up compacted soils.
We always hear about the hard hooves doing so much damage, but because we have such an incredible problem with hard crusts on the surface, how do we break that? Do we do that mechanically with spending a lot of money? Or what we often see, people can get extraordinary results with high density herd impact just to crack that hard top on it. I think we have to just change our focus that little bit with being aware that we need to use livestock to improve the landscape. So if we get to the point where they're not improving it, then they need moving on, or, you know, imitating what nature did. The best soils in the world developed with those large herds of animals passing over it, but they'd get long rest periods. They'd probably get the 12 months.
Glenn says that managing livestock movements and resting pastures is important to get the right amount of disturbance in the landscape for water infiltration, soil aeration, and plant growth. Alejandro, who we heard from earlier, agrees that landscapes need to be actively managed.
Most grasslands are dying not because of too many animals, but because of undergrazing. Because we all need to remember that grasses co-evolve with grazers, and those grasses need to be eaten at some point. That idea of resting a glaze 5 to 10 years is not a good idea, because your grasses are going to start decaying and oxidizing and dying. So at some point in time, you need to do a good grazing, like intensive grazing.
Alejandro uses livestock to manage the pastures, and his approach is to move his herd as often as 2 times a day using a strip grazing paddock design. This allows for around 18 months of recovery before returning livestock to the area, which Alejandro believes is the right amount of grazing pressure needed for his country.
We have been evolving the way we graze, because I think at the beginning we were just to focus on building soil, and I think we forgot about the cows. And I think on this kind of grazing that we practice today, the cows are really leading all the decisions. Let's say that we're moving every day. We want to see the cows calm, happy, full every morning. How? Because, well, you know, most of them are laying down, and you can actually sense or perceive how the cows are doing by how they behave. And that will give you like a feedback every day of whether you're giving enough feed for the cows.
How does that observation help you manage the performance of your livestock?
In my ranch, we have a mountain range, we have flats, and we have hills. And the cows really need to perform on all these environments. So there will be cows that perform in one or two environments well, but not on the other. I mean, we call as often as every other week. We don't wait, because also one very important factor in ranching is timing. We try to spot any problems on time, because it's going to cost us more later on. So we call and pull those cows out of the herd, and then we reward those cows by putting in a bigger, nice pasture, like well-rested pasture, where they can select whatever they want. So they actually rebound, and then they are sold. And that is for the poor performers. And now for the top of that herd, we are also looking during calving season for those cows that keep a good body condition, nice shiny coat, they shed their hair during the spring and things like that.
So by developing a breed that is better adapted for your environment, your landscape and livestock are benefiting. You also talk about the different types of animals used for grazing.
When I was in Australia and I was promoting the multi-grazers, including donkeys, because donkeys really help a lot with finishing the work because cows are more selective and donkeys graze very even. And one rancher was telling me that he used to have like 300 horses, and the whole purpose behind those horses was every 7 years to graze every pasture. So like renewing the pastures. Let's not think about the monoculture of just cattle.
Since changing your grazing management to be more in sync with nature, what changes have you observed in the landscape?
One of the first things that you see is that you start extending the green season of the grasses and also the diversity of the grasses. Because when we started back, like let's say 15 years ago with this kind of grazing management, we only have no more than 10 different grass species.
We want to have 200 different grasses, forbs or herbs, because they even have more energy, like broadleafs, you know, they have more energy and more protein than the grasses. You should have a combination of grasses and broadleafs of plants that will help you during the rainy season to really get the cows really happy and fat.
We've been working all these years with the bird conservancy organizations in the U.S. These birds, migratory birds, come from southern Canada and northern U.S., and they winter here in our grasslands. So if we don't have grassland, then we break the whole cycle. Those specific birds have been declined up to 70%. Only 30% remain in the last 40 years. So we are really a very critical link on the survival of these species. And the last count that they did at the ranch, they counted about 100 different grasses. So we went from 10 grasses to more than 100 different grasses. And we need to keep in mind that the more diversity you have, the more resilient you become.
So it's clear in moving your cattle so often, you're getting the benefits to the landscape and building resilience. But can you talk about the cost of labor for moving your stock so often?
Yeah, I think if we want to have a sustainable operation, we need to be profitable. And people get really concerned when we say that we move once a day or twice a day or even sometimes even more. But we move as much as twice a day. But I know some friends would move multiple times per day. But you don't really need that many people. We have 500 cows, 400 sheep, and some other livestock. And we only have, well, like the foreman. And we have a cowboy and we have the chirper. And that's it. And then we also like to simplify all the equipment. We have one small truck, we have a tractor, and that's it. We're already working on the water system. We're moving the main line from 2-inch to 3-inch pipeline. So we will have more water than we need because our water system right now can support about 700 cows. But we want to move into 1,200 cows in the same land, you know, the same acreage, with the same people, same deal.
Right now we're dealing with the worst drought in the last 80 years. We're still grazing, so we still have reserves to keep going without actually spending too much money on keeping the cows going. Because we still have stockpiled grass, and that's really helping us minimize any expenses to carry on with the drought.
Jody saw the potential for this style of grazing management in her Australian context, and has taken some of Alejandro's insights on board.
As far as our grazing management goes, that's probably the most relevant lever we could pull in the rangelands. That is just a constantly evolving thing that we're trying to shift into this more regenerative grazing system. And it's been a pretty kind of higgledy-piggledy approach. We certainly haven't had a uniform sort of transformation of the property because we have some areas that it's like a 10,000-acre paddock pretty much with gidgee scrub all through it. And so it's going to take a lot longer to change things there than on our other end where we've already split up a few paddocks. But it's good because it does give you this idea of varying impacts with different interventions. So last year we had mobbed out our breeding herd and we're moving them through a series of paddocks, two of which had previously been one and been split in half. And it was almost the first time we'd followed them, we'd pushed them through in that manner. It's nowhere near the density that Alejandro is suggesting, and we are going to trial that density this year. But even just last year, something that we noticed that was just hugely exciting was you take cattle out of a paddock sooner than you would have historically, you soon notice the advantage you get out of the smaller rainfall events. So I remember driving through, I was running horses through a paddock and just looking on the way going, oh my gosh, we only had a small fall here and we've got all these like new baby Mitchell grass plants coming up amongst other plants. But yeah, like the main perennial species that was popping up was more of these Mitchell grass, which is one of our prevalent species. But if those cattle had stayed there, like even if they'd stayed there another week, because of the condition of that pasture, those baby plants would have been the most palatable plant there and they would have been gone. And the amount of plants that I was seeing now, I could see how if you got that number of baby plants every year, you'd be looking at like maybe 30% increases in your perennial biomass once they reach maturity. And that's huge. But also just like the response times being quicker. So getting plants becoming green faster in response to rain and then staying green longer, which is essentially what Alejandro keeps talking about, right? This extension of photosynthesis throughout the season in your plants, which is critical out here. So because it's so volatile, one of the biggest challenges is actually just when you are going to destock it and by how much you're decreasing your herd. Yes, so it's already being demonstrated really clearly in my mind that we can have so much more ground cover, it can be of like better quality plants, and we can have green for longer throughout the season.
As Jody says, ground cover and organic matter are key when it comes to building resilience to drought and floods. Glenn has been measuring infiltration rates to demonstrate what is possible.
There's a lot of science talking about how a lot of the grasslands within in Queensland are down to probably 50% productivity. And it's because they become monocultures. Unless you've got a certain number of diversity in your plant life, the soil shuts down. Unless you feed the soil, unless you put that organic matter back in the soil, you end up stuck in that drought and flood cycle. So when you're talking about flooding, what we're finding, we've done a lot of tests and we're seeing what is the next level, where can we take it all to? Where we've got bare soils, the initial water infiltration tests we did, we're looking at 3 inches of water still sitting on the ground 10 minutes later, where it's got that hard cap. As soon as you get that organic matter back, as soon as you get that plant life, as soon as you get grass there, you're starting to look at 3 inches disappearing in 1.5 minutes. Well, I've never seen a 3-inch storm in 1.5 minutes. But I've taken that even further to the next step, and this is where it really starts to highlight what people see with flooding, that if you've got the right mix of plants and you're not just talking with annuals, you get this enormous sponge that goes down a couple of meters, and it's just a solid mass of organic matter. When you've got that organic sponge like that, the other day I did a water infiltration test, and we were looking at 10 inches in 10 minutes. You're always going to get those flooding events. I'm not trying to dismiss them. They do happen, but instead of them being once every 100 years, they're suddenly once every 20 years or once every 10 years.
So increasing ground cover with a diversity of species can reduce the impacts of both flooding and drought. What are the other things that a farmer can do to reduce water evaporation in a low rainfall region?
Something I'm very passionate about is looking after those keystone tree species. Their role is just so fundamentally important. We have a lot of those big old trees that have incredible age to them that are dying because a lot of them have evolved in a symbiotic relationship with pasture. And if you remove that pasture, suddenly you don't have the water infiltration around them. You have incredible soil temperatures. They don't even get to cool down at night. The soil gets so hot, so cooked that overnight, you know, they're still burning inside. And so a lot of those big old keystone trees have been and dying. We also have a lot of issues with them getting overcrowded by woody weeds, getting choked out. And the woody veg underneath them is so thick that there's bare soil underneath that. And there's all this erosion. All the topsoil is washing away. So getting that balance is incredibly important. It's really important one way or another to be able to control regrowth around them, get the pasture back and get balance there. And we talk about what is a healthy ratio of canopy cover. And you hear some figures bandied around, maybe 20% or whatever it is. I'm actually finding that my greatest productivity is with the right tree species at the right density. I'm actually nearly looking at 100% canopy, but my trees are probably 20 to 30 meters apart. They're huge, big trees. And when you get those big rainfall events, their roots are so much stronger, so much more aggressive. They're opening up all those hard pans. They're creating soil down to massive depths, taking carbon down, taking water down, but they're also bringing nutrients up. That nutrient cycle that they bring up is then shared in the pasture. That's what keeps our pasture healthy. The pasture helps keep the trees healthy, and the trees keep the pasture healthy. Out here, we have far too much sunlight. Our sunlight in summer is ridiculous. So a filtered sunlight, a dappled sunlight through those huge trees is just what the grass needs. It stops it getting cooked. Some of our best pasture grows under certain trees at the right density. And if you look underneath them, you'll see a massive amount of fungal activity. And we hear that, don't we, that your forests are fungal-dominated soils and your grasslands are bacterial. And why is that? You know, if you stop and think about it, if you mow your lawn, where does all that organic matter go? It disappears. It's not long-lasting. It's not lignified enough to last. The leaf matter and the twigs and branches that fall out of trees is more lignified, and it lasts for long enough that fungi can get developed in it. And you see all that white mass in it. And I would love to show you photos of it. It's pretty spectacular. It's incredibly exciting.
The low rainfall part of the rangelands covers 81% of Australia. Are there other agricultural opportunities that we're just not seeing at the moment?
Yes, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. The native grain belt, I don't know whether you've ever seen a map of it in Australia, the native grain belt is in this central rangelands. That's quite an interest of mine too. I don't know how much you're aware of it with your family, but a lot of my family have intolerances now, and it's only developed in later years, but food intolerances, but particularly your gluten type things.
Yes.
And a lot of those modified grains are so modified that our bodies can't handle them anymore. So we do hear talk about some of the native grains and some work being done with them already. There are others that are not very common anymore, that used to be very common and that the Aboriginal people were living on. And you see a lot of evidence of it in their campfires and where they had the bread fires, where a lot of those plants were growing. But it's a lot of your native sorghums, the grains on those. So a lot of those different grains and your native millets aren't going to cause those issues for people who have gluten intolerance. So I do actually see a lot of potential to start trying to grow those on a commercial scale. Yeah, I think it'd be a massive opportunity. We have really some of the most productive country, you know, whether you're talking the channel country or even a lot of these other small floodplains. When they're functioning well, when you see them restored, it's really mind-boggling, the potential of them and how productive they are. You can nearly keep water running through some of these systems all year long once they're functioning. We're talking massive scale. You know, one I was looking at the other day was 80,000 acres, massive areas. And when they're not functioning, it has a huge impact on the wildlife. There's a national park near here, I don't know if you're familiar with it, at the bottom of Queensland, the Kurrawinya National Park, and it's a Ramsar site. And so you get bird life come there from all over the world. There are Siberian birds go there when it's got water in it. And then you've got the likes of Lake Eyre. Extraordinary. But for all the other small wetlands within the region, if they're not functioning, those birds struggle to, A, make it all the way to the big ones, or then struggle to make it back out again. You know, they don't have those stopover points. So those big wetlands that we're restoring have an enormous role within the world.
The importance of making the most of the rain that does fall can't be understated. However, Jody sees another challenge to restoring the rangelands.
I honestly think one of the biggest challenges is that idea of the handing over of knowledge tied in with succession, because we have such a transient population out here, we don't have that same level of one generation to the next handing down knowledge about landscapes. And obviously the tremendous wealth of knowledge and wisdom within First Nations communities has been disrupted. So when we learn something, how do we pass that on? And so we had a two-day event here, which was a conference one day, field day the next, and then after that, a two-day grazing workshop with Alejandro's. And we had this wonderful Welcome to Country by Suzanne Thompson from Yatudak, who's an Innangai woman, and Josh Gorringe came, who's a mate of mine from the Channel Country, but also runs the Mithika Aboriginal Corporation. And so it was this beautiful mixture of sort of region leaders and First Nations and scientists. And I really wanted that thing of genuine connection between people. So not just networking for the sake of networking, but I wanted people to sit down around a campfire at night and share stories. Because I think listening to the way someone speaks or laughs or the things, the thoughts that pop out of their head, like that's how you actually really build genuine community and understand where someone's coming from. And so that's really what I wanted to do. I think that's actually one of the most exciting things. Once you start building community around regenerative principles in your rangelands, you only have to impact and reach a handful of people to then see positive change at ecosystem scale. Because we are talking about such vast areas, the potential of that is staggering.
Alejandro, you inspired a lot of people at the Rangelands Conference in Australia. How do you go about sharing your knowledge and inspiring others in Mexico?
I was very blessed to have really great people here in the state of Chihuahua, Mexico, doing holistic management with a lot of years. They were my mentors. And then we created like a small group and we started traveling and learning from the best. And that's how, as a group, we started making more progress. But I think one fundamental thing that helped us a lot was this community effort, because I don't think nobody can do it by themselves. We need the help of others. And we also start understanding that the most important people that we need to work is our neighbors, because we cannot be sustainable if we're just an island of grass in the middle of nowhere, because we're affected by the whole ecosystem we live in. And by working with our neighbors, we are going to create a more healthier community.
A lot of Australian farmers have been having a really tough time with fire, droughts, floods. It seems like an endless cycle. What do you want these farmers to know?
Yeah, I mean, that there's hope. Don't give up on what you're doing. Don't give up on your dreams. There's a way to do better, and we've been proving that. It's not like a plan or something. We have our ranches as a proof that something great can happen and that things can be way better than what we thought.
Jody has been working really hard to build community in the rangelands and has been taking some courses and has even been part of a film recently. What keeps her going is her clear vision for the future.
So it was a Regen Ag mentoring program, and one of the things we had to do was a holistic context session where we wrote our aspirations for the land. And I described it like this: a diverse kaleidoscope biologically, a mosaic of soil, pasture and vegetation that is spiraling upward, productive in terms of pasture and abundant in terms of providing habitat for wildlife. Lots of birds and good water with ample shade trees and a reliable climate. That's the vision.
This podcast has been produced by the Grow Love Project in collaboration with Soils for Life. We'd like to thank all the guests for their time and insights. For more information, check out the links in the show notes, sign up to the Soils for Life newsletter, and be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Thanks for listening.